She was returning to her desk when the front door suddenly opened. It was David Zink, bright and sober, with a big smile, sharp suit, cashmere overcoat, and two thick briefcases loaded to the max. "Well, well, if it ain't Mr. Harvard," Rochelle said. "I'm back. I'm surprised you could find us. It wasn't easy. Where's my office?" "Well, let's see. I'm not sure we have one. Perhaps we should ask the two bosses about this." She nodded to Oscar's door, beyond which voices could be heard. "So they're here?" David asked. "Yes, they usually start the day with a round of bickering." "I see. Look, Harvard, are you sure you know what you're doing? This is another world. You're taking a plunge here, leaving the fancy life of corporate law for the Bush Leagues. You might get hurt out here, and you sure won't make any money."
"I've done the big firm thing, Ms. Gibson, and I'll jump off a bridge before I go back. Just give me a little room somewhere to park myself, and I'll figure it out."
The door opened, and Wally and Oscar emerged. They froze when they saw David standing in front of Rochelle's desk. Wally smiled and said, "Well, good morning, David. You look surprisingly healthy." "Thank you, and I'd like to apologize for my appearance yesterday." He nodded at all three as he spoke. "You caught me at the tail end of a rather unusual episode, but it was nonetheless a very important day in my life. I quit the big firm, and here I am, ready to go to work."
"What type of work do you have in mind?" Oscar asked.
David gave a slight shrug as if he didn't have a clue. "For the past 5 years, I've labored in the dungeon of bond underwriting, with emphasis on second and third tier aftermarket spreads, primarily for foreign multinational corporations that prefer to avoid paying taxes anywhere in the world. If you have no idea what that is, then don't worry. No one else does either. What it means is that a small team of us idiots labored 15 hours a day in a room with no windows, creating paperwork and more paperwork. I've never seen the inside of a courtroom, or a courthouse for that matter. Never met a judge when he was wearing a robe. Never offered a hand to help a person who needed a real lawyer. To answer your question, Mr. Finley, I'm here to do anything. Think of me as a rookie fresh out of law school who doesn't know his ass from a hole in the ground, but I'm a quick study." Compensation should have been the next issue, but the partners were reluctant to talk money in front of Rochelle. She, of course, would take the position that anyone they hired, lawyer or otherwise, should be paid less than she was.
"There is some space upstairs," Wally said.
"I'll take it."
"It's a junk room," Oscar said.
"I'll take it," David said, lifting his two briefcases, ready to move in.
"I haven't been up there in years," Rochelle said, rolling her eyes, obviously unhappy with the firm's sudden expansion.
A narrow door next to the kitchen led to a stairway. David followed Wally, with Oscar bringing up the rear. Wally was excited about having someone to help hustle Crayox cases. Oscar was thinking only of how much this might cost in salary, withholding taxes, unemployment deductions, and, heaven forbid, health insurance. Finley and Fig offered little in the way of benefits. No 401k, no IRA, no retirement of any kind, and certainly no health or dental plan. Rochelle had been griping for years because she was forced to buy her own private policy, as did the two partners. What if young David here expected health insurance?
As Oscar climbed the stairs, he felt the burden of a heavier overhead. More spent at the office meant less to take home. His retirement seemed even more elusive. The junk room was exactly that, a dark, dusty landfill with spider webs and pieces of old furniture and boxes of files.
"I like it," David said when Wally switched on the light.
He must be crazy, Oscar thought.
But there was a small desk and a couple of chairs. David saw only the potential. And there were two windows. Sunlight would be a nice addition to his life. When it was dark outside, he would be at home with Helen, procreating.
Oscar swiped away a large spider web and said, "Look, David, we can offer a small salary, but you're going to have to generate your own fees. And this won't be easy, at least initially."
Initially? Oscar had been struggling to generate meager fees for over 30 years.
"What's the deal?" David asked.
Oscar looked at Wally, and Wally looked at the wall. The two had not hired an associate in 15 years, nor had they even considered doing so. David's presence had caught them by surprise. As the senior partner, Oscar felt compelled to take the initiative.
"We can pay $1,000 a month, and you keep half of what you bring in. After 6 months, we'll reevaluate."
Wally jumped in quickly with,
"It will be rough at first, lots of competition out there on the streets."
We can toss some files your way, Oscar added.
We'll give you a piece of the Crayox litigation, Wally said, as if they were already banking huge fees.
The what? David asked.
Never mind, Oscar said with a frown.
Look, guys, David said with a smile. He was far more at ease than they were. I've made a very nice salary for the past 5 years. I've spent a lot, but there's a chunk in the bank. Don't worry about me. I'll take the deal.
And with that, he thrust out a hand, shaking Oscar's first, then Wally's.
Chapter 10. David cleaned for the next hour. He wiped dust from the desk and chairs. He found an old Hoover in the kitchen and vacuumed the plank floors. He filled 3 large bags with trash and put them on the small porch out back. He stopped occasionally to admire the windows and sunlight, something he'd never done at Rogan Rothberg. Sure, on a clear day, the view across Lake Michigan was captivating, but he had learned during his first year with the firm that time spent gazing out from the Trust Tower was time that could not be billed. Rookie associates were placed in bunker-like cubicles where they toiled around the clock and, with time, forgot about sunshine and daydreaming. Now David couldn't stay away from the windows. The view, admittedly, was not as captivating. Looking down, he could see the massage parlor, and beyond it, the intersection of Preston Beach and 38th, the very spot where he'd taken a piece of metal to the slime ball, Gulston, and chased him away. Beyond the intersection was a block of more converted bungalows. Not much of a view, but David liked it anyway. It represented an exciting change in his life, a new challenge. It meant freedom. Wally dropped in every 10 minutes to check on things, and it became obvious he had something on his mind. Finally, after an hour, he said, "Say, David, I'm doing court at 11, divorce court. I doubt you've ever been there, so I was thinking you could tag along and I'll introduce you to the judge."
The cleaning had become monotonous. David said, "Let's go." As they were leaving through the back door, Wally said, "Is that your Audi SUV?"
"It is."
"Do you mind driving? I'll do the talking."
"Sure."
As they were pulling onto Preston, Wally said,
"Look, David, the truth is that I got a DUI a year ago and my license is suspended."
"There, I said it. I believe in being honest."
"Okay, you've certainly seen me drunk enough."
"I have indeed, but your cute wife told me you're not much of a drinker."
"I, on the other hand, have quite a history. I'm sober for 61 days now. Every day is a challenge. I go to AA, and I've rehabbed several times. What else do you want to know?"
"I didn't bring this up."
"Oscar, he has a few strong ones every night. Believe me, with his wife, he needs them, but he keeps it under control. Some people are like that, you know, they can stop with 2 or 3. They could skip a few days, even weeks, no problem. Others can't stop until they black out, kind of like you yesterday."
"Thanks, Wally. Where are we headed, by the way?"
"The Daily Center downtown, 50 West Washington."
"Me, I do fine for a while. I've quit 4 or 5 times, you know."
"Well, how would I know that?"
"Anyway, enough of the booze. What's wrong with Oscar's wife?"
Wally whistled and looked out the side window for a moment.
"Tough woman, man. One of these people who grew up in a nicer part of town. Father wore a suit and tie to work, as opposed to a uniform, so she was raised to believe she's better than most. A real snat. She made a major mistake when she married Oscar because she figured he was a lawyer, right? Lawyers make lots of money, right?"
"Not exactly. Oscar has never made enough to satisfy her, and she hammers him relentlessly because she wants more money. I loathe the woman. You won't meet her because she refuses to set foot in the office, which suits me just fine."
"Why not get a divorce?"
"That's what I've been saying for years. Me, I got no problem with divorce. Been down that road 4 times.
4 times?
"Yep, and every trip was worth the hassle. You know what they say, the reason divorce is so expensive is because it's worth it."
Wally laughed at this stale punchline.
"Are you married now?" David asked, somewhat cautiously.
"Nope, back on the prowl,"
Wally said smugly, as if no woman were safe. David couldn't imagine a less attractive person hitting on females in bars and at parties. So, in less than 15 minutes, he had learned Wally was a recovering alcoholic with 4 ex-wives, several trips through rehab, and at least 1 DUI. David decided to stop with the questions. Over breakfast with Helen, he had dug a bit online and learned that 1, 10 years earlier, Finley and Fig had settled a sexual harassment suit brought by a former secretary. 2, On one occasion, Oscar had been reprimanded by the State Bar Association for overcharging a client in a divorce case. 3, on 2 prior occasions, Wally had been reprimanded by the State Bar Association for blatant solicitation of clients who'd been injured in auto accidents, including an apparently messy affair involving Wally wearing doctor scrubs and barging into the hospital room of a badly wounded teenager who died an hour later. 4, at least 4 former clients had sued the firm, alleging malpractice, though it was unclear if any recovered damages. And 5, the firm had been mentioned in a scathing article written by a professor of legal ethics who was sick of lawyers advertising. And all of this was just over breakfast. Helen had been alarmed, but David took a hard, cynical line and argued that such dubious behavior couldn't touch the cutthroat brand of law practiced by the fine folks at Rogan Rothberg. He had only to mention the Strick River case to win the argument. The Strick River in Wisconsin had been thoroughly polluted by an infamous chemical company represented by Rogan Rothberg, and after decades of brutal litigation and skillful legal wrangling, the dumping continued. Wally was digging through his briefcase. The skyline came into view, and David looked at the tall, majestic buildings crowded together in downtown Chicago. The Trust Tower was in the center. "I would be there right now," he said softly, almost to himself. Wally looked up, saw the skyline, and realized what David was thinking. "Which one?" Wally asked. "The Trust Tower." "I was in the Sears Tower one summer, a clerk after my second year of law school, Martin and Wheeler, and I thought that's what I wanted." "What happened?" "Couldn't pass the bar exam." David added that to the growing list of defects. "You're not going to miss it, are you?" Wally asked. "No, I'm breaking into a sweat right now just looking at the building. I don't want to get any closer. Take a left on Washington. We're almost there." Inside the Richard J. Daley Center, they passed through security scanners and took the elevator to the 16th floor. The place was bustling with lawyers and litigants, clerks and cops, either hustling about or huddled in little pockets of serious conversations. Justice was looming, and everyone seemed to be dreading it. David had no idea where he was going or what he was doing, so he stuck close to Wally, who seemed quite at home. David was carrying his briefcase, which held only a single legal pad. They passed courtroom after courtroom. "Have you really never seen the inside of a courtroom?" Wally asked as they walked quickly, their shoes clicking along on the worn marble tile. "Not since law school." "Unbelievable. What have you been doing for the past 5 years? You don't want to know." "I'm sure you're right about that." "This is us," Wally said, pointing to the heavy double doors of a courtroom. A sign said, "Circuit Court of Cook County, Divorce Division, Honorable Charles Bradbury." "Who's Bradbury?" David asked. "You're about to meet him." Wally opened the door and they stepped inside. There were a few spectators scattered through the rows of benches. The lawyers were seated up front, bored and waiting. The witness chair was empty. No trial was in progress. Judge Bradbury was reviewing a document and taking his time. David and Wally sat in the second row. Wally scanned the courtroom, saw his client, smiled and nodded. He whispered to David, "This is known as an open day as opposed to a trial day. Generally speaking, you can get motions granted, routine matters approved, crap like that. That lady over there, in the short yellow dress, is our beloved client, Deanna Nuxhall, and she thinks she's about to get another divorce." "Another?" David asked as he glanced over. Deanna winked at him. Bleach blonde, huge chest, legs everywhere. "I've done one already. This would be my second. I think she has a prior. Looks like a stripper." "Nothing would surprise me." Judge Bradbury signed some papers. Lawyers approached the bench, chatted with him, got what they wanted, and left. 15 minutes passed, and Wally was getting anxious. "Mr. Fig," the judge said. Wally and David walked through the bar, past the tables, and approached the bench, a low one that allowed the lawyers to almost see eye to eye with his honor. Bradbury shoved the microphone away so they could chat without being heard. "What's up?" he said. "We have a new associate, Your Honor," Wally said proudly. "Meet David Zink." David reached over and shook hands with the judge, who received him warmly. "Welcome to my courtroom," he said. "David's been with a big firm downtown. Now he wants to see the real side of justice," Wally said. "You won't learn much from Fig," Bradbury said with a chuckle. "He went to Harvard Law School," Wally said, even prouder.
Then what are you doing here? The judge asked and appeared to be dead serious.
Got sick of the big firm, David said,
while he was handing over some paperwork.
We have a slight problem here, Judge. My client is the lovely Deanna Nuxhall, fourth row left in the yellow dress.
Bradbury peered slightly over his reading glasses and said, She looks familiar.
Yep, she was here about a year ago, second or third divorce.
Same dress, I think.
Yes, I think so too. Same dress, but the boobs are new.
You getting any?
Not yet.
David felt faint. The judge and the lawyer were discussing sex with the client in open court, though no one could hear.
What's the problem? Bradbury asked.
I haven't been paid. She owes $300 and I can't seem to squeeze it out of her.
What parts have you squeezed?
Ha ha, she refuses to pay, Judge.
I need a closer look.
Wally turned and motioned for Ms. Nuxhall to join them at the bench. She stood and wiggled herself from between the benches, then proceeded to the front. The lawyers went mute. The two bailiffs woke up. The other spectators gawked. The dress was even shorter when she walked, and she wore platform-spiked heels that would make a hooker blush. David eased as far away as possible when she joined the boys at the bench. Judge Bradbury pretended not to notice her. He was far too occupied with the contents of the court file.
Basic no-fault divorce, right, Mr. Figg?
That's correct, Your Honor,
Wally replied properly. Is everything in order?
Yes, except for the small matter of my fee.
I just noticed that, Bradbury said with a frown. It looks as though there is a balance of $300, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Bradbury peered over his reading glasses and took in the chest first, then the eyes.
Are you prepared to take care of the fee, Ms. Nuxhall?
Yes, Your Honor, she said in a squeaky voice. But I'll have to wait until next week. You see, I'm getting married this Saturday, and, well, I just can't swing it right now.
His eyes dancing from her chest to her face, His Honor said,
It's my experience, Miss Nuxhall, in divorce cases the fees are never paid after the fact. I expect my lawyers to be taken care of, to be paid, before I sign the final orders.
What is the total fee, Mr. Figg?
$600. She paid half up front.
$600? Bradbury said, feigning disbelief. That's a very reasonable fee, Miss Nuxhall. Why haven't you paid your lawyer?
Her eyes were suddenly wet. The lawyers and spectators couldn't hear the details, but they nonetheless kept their eyes on Deanna, especially her legs and shoes. David backed away even more, shocked at this shakedown in open court. Bradbury moved in for the kill. He raised his voice slightly and said, I'm not granting this divorce today, Ms. Nuxhall. You get your lawyer paid, then I'll sign the papers. You understand this?
Wiping her cheeks, she said, Please.
I'm sorry, but I run a tight ship. I insist that all obligations be met. Alimony, child support, legal fees. It's just $300. Go borrow it from a friend.
I've tried, Your Honor, but...
Please, I hear this all the time. You're excused.
She turned around and walked away, His Honor leering at every step.
Wally watched too, shaking his head, marveling, as if ready to pounce. When the door closed, the courtroom breathed again. Judge Bradbury took a sip of water and said, Anything else?
One more, Judge. Joni Brenner, no fault, complete property settlement, no children, and most important, my fee has been paid in full.
Get her up here.
I'm not sure if I'm cut out for divorce law, David admitted. They were back on the street, inching along in noon traffic, leaving the Daily Center behind.
Great. You've been to court one time now for less than an hour, and you're already streamlining your practice? Wally replied.
Do most judges do what Bradbury just did?
What, you mean protect his lawyers?
No, most judges have forgotten what it's like to be in the trenches.
As soon as they put on the black robe, they forget.
Bradbury, he's different. He remembers what a bunch of creeps we represent.
So what happens now? Will Deanna get her divorce?
She'll stop by the office this afternoon with the money and we'll get the divorce on Friday. She gets married on Saturday, and in 6 months or so, she'll be back for another divorce.
I rest my case. I'm not cut out for divorce work.
Oh, it sucks all right. 90% of what we do sucks. We hustle the nickel and dime stuff to pay the overhead and dream of the big case. But last night, David, I didn't dream. And I'll tell you why.
Ever hear of a drug called Crayox, a cholesterol drug?
No.
Well, you will. It's killing people right and left. No doubt the next big mass tort wave of litigation. And we got to get in fast.
Where are we going?
I need to run a quick errand, and since we're downtown, it won't take a second.
A minute later, David parked illegally outside of Abner's.
Ever been here? He asked.
Oh, sure. There aren't many bars with which I'm unacquainted, David, but it's been a while. This is where I spent yesterday, and I need to pay my bar bill.
Why didn't you pay it yesterday?
Because I couldn't find my pockets, remember?
I'll wait in the car, Wally said, then took a long, lustful look at the door into Abner's. Miss Spence was on her throne, eyes glazed, cheeks red, in another world. Abner was hustling around the bar, mixing drinks, pouring beer, sliding along platters of burgers. David caught him near the cash register and said,
"Hey, I'm back."
Abner smiled and said,
"So, you're alive after all."
"Oh, sure, just left court. You got my tab somewhere close?"
Abner fished through a drawer and pulled out a ticket.
"Let's call it $130.
"Is that all?"
David handed over two $100 bills and said, "Keep it."
"Your chick is over there," Abner said, nodding at Miss Spence, whose eyes were temporarily closed.
"She's not as cute today," David said.
"I got a friend in finance. He was in last night. Says she's worth $8 billion.
On second thought, I think she likes you, but you'd better hurry."
"I'd better leave her alone. Thanks for taking care of me."
"No problem. Come back and see me sometime."
Highly unlikely, David thought, as they quickly shook hands. Chapter 11. For an unlicensed driver, Wally proved to be a skillful navigator. Somewhere near Midway Airport, he directed David through a series of quick turns onto short streets, delivered them from two impossible dead ends, insisted he drive two blocks the wrong way, and did it all with a nonstop monologue that included, "I know this place like the back of my hand," several times. They parked at the curb, in front of a sagging duplex with aluminum foil covering the windows, a barbecue grill on the front porch, and a huge orange cat guarding the front door. "And who lives here?" David asked, taking in the rundown neighborhood. Two sketchy teenagers across the street seemed fascinated by his shiny Audi.
"Here liveth a lovely woman by the name of Iris Klopek, widow of Percy Klopek, who died about 18 months ago at the age of 48. Died in his sleep. Very sad. They came to see me about a divorce one time, but then changed their minds. As I recall, he was rather obese, but not nearly as large as she."
The two lawyers were sitting in the car talking as if they did not want to get out. Only a couple of FBI agents in black suits and a black sedan could have been more conspicuous.
"So why are we here?" David asked. "Crayox, my friend, Crayox. I want to talk to Iris and see if by chance Percy had been on the drug when he died. If so, then voila! We have another Crayox case worth somewhere between $2 and $4 million. Any more questions?"
Oh, dozens of questions. David's mind was spinning as he realized they were about to cold call Ms. Klopek to inquire about her dead husband. "Is she expecting us?" he asked.
"I haven't called, have you?"
"No, actually."
Wally yanked open the door and got out. David reluctantly did the same and managed to frown at the teenagers admiring his car. The orange cat refused to move from the doormat. The doorbell could not be heard from outside, so Wally commenced knocking, louder and louder, while David continued to glance nervously at the street. Finally, a chain was heard, then a crack in the door.
"Who is it?" a woman asked. "Attorney Wally Figg looking for Ms. Iris Klopek?"
The door opened, and through the glass storm door, Iris presented herself. As large as advertised, she wore what appeared to be a beige bedsheet with openings for her head and arms.
"Who are you?" she asked.
"Wally Figg, Iris. I met you and Percy when you were thinking about a divorce. Probably 3 years ago, you guys came to my office over on Preston."
"Percy's dead," she said.
"Yes, I know. I'm sorry. That's why I'm here. I want to talk to you about his death. I'm curious about what medications he was taking when he died."
"Why does it matter?"
"Because there's a lot of litigation over cholesterol drugs and painkillers and antidepressants. Some of these drugs killed thousands of people. There could be a lot of money on the table."
A pause as she looked at them.
"The house is a wreck," she said.
What a surprise, thought David. They followed her inside to a narrow, dirty kitchen and sat at the table. She fixed instant coffee in three mix-match Bears mugs, then sat across from them. David's chair was a flimsy wooden model that felt as though it might collapse any second. Hers appeared to be of the same variety. The trip to the door, then to the kitchen, along with the preparation of the coffee, had winded her. There was sweat on her spongy forehead. Wally finally got around to introducing David to Ms. Klopek.
"David went to Harvard Law, and he's just joined our firm," Wally said.
She did not offer a hand to shake, nor did Mr. Harvard. She could not have cared less where David, Wally, or anyone else went to college or law school. Her breathing was as noisy as an old furnace. The room smelled of dried cat urine and yesterday's nicotine. Wally again expressed his phony condolences for dear Percy's demise, then quickly got to the point.
"The main drug I'm after is called Crayox, a cholesterol drug. Was Percy taking it when he died?"
With no hesitation, she said,
"Yes, he'd taken it for years. I used to take it, but I quit."
Wally was at once thrilled by Percy's usage and disappointed that Iris had given it up.
"Something wrong with Crayox?" she asked.
"Oh, yes, very wrong," Molly said, rubbing his hands together. He launched into what was becoming a fluid and compelling case against Crayox and Varick Labs. He cherry-picked facts and figures from the preliminary research that was being touted by the mass tort lawyers. He quoted heavily from the one-sided lawsuit filed in Fort Lauderdale. He made a convincing case that time was of the essence and Iris needed to sign on with Finley and Fig immediately.
"How much will it cost me?" she asked.
"Not a penny," Wally fired back. "We front the expenses of litigation and take 40% of the recovery." The coffee tasted like salt water. After one sip, David wanted to spit. Iris, though, seemed to savor it. She took a long drink, swirled it around her mammoth mouth, then swallowed.
40% sounds like a lot," she said. "This is very complicated litigation, Iris. Against a corporation with $1 zillion and 1,000 lawyers. Look at it like this. Right now, you have 60% of nothing. In a year or two, if you hire our firm, you could have 60% of something big."
"How big?"
"Tough question, Iris, but then I remember that you always ask the tough questions. That's what I always liked about you. Tough questions, and to be honest, I can't answer it, because no one can predict what a jury might do. The jury might see the truth about Crayox and get ticked off at Varick and give you $5 million. Or the jury might believe the lies put forth by Varick and its shifty lawyers and give you nothing. Me, I tend to think the case will go for around $1 million, Iris, but you gotta understand that I'm not making any promises."
He looked at David and said,
"Right, David? We can't make promises in cases like this. Nothing is guaranteed."
"That's right," David said convincingly, the new mass tort specialist. She sloshed some more salt water around her mouth and glared at Wally.
"I could sure use some help," she said. "It's just me and Clint, and he's only working part-time these days."
Wally and David were taking notes and nodding along as if they knew exactly who Clint was. She did not bother to elaborate.
"I'm living off $1,200 a month Social Security, so anything you can get would be great."
"We'll get you something, Iris. I feel sure of it."
"When might this happen?" "Another tough question, Iris. One theory is that Varick will get hit so hard with Crayox cases that the company will surrender and negotiate a huge settlement. Most of the lawyers, including me, expect this to happen within the next 24 months. The other theory is that Varick will take a few of these cases to trial to sort of test the waters around the country, see what juries think about their drug. If this happens, it might take longer to force a settlement."
Even David, with a fine law degree and 5 years of experience, was beginning to believe Wally knew what he was talking about. The junior partner went on, "If a settlement occurs, and we certainly believe it will happen, the death cases will be negotiated first. Then Varick will be desperate to settle all of the non-death cases, folks like you."
"I'm a non-death case?" she asked, confused.
"For now. The scientific evidence is not clear, but there appears to be a decent chance that Crayox is responsible for heart damage in many people who are otherwise healthy." How anyone could look at Iris Klopek and deem her healthy was mind-blowing, at least to David.
"Mercy," she said as her eyes watered. "That's all I need, more heart problems."
"Don't worry about it now," Wally said, without the slightest trace of reassurance. "We'll get to your case later. The important thing is to get Percy signed up. You're his widow and his principal heir. Therefore, you need to hire me and act as his representative."
He produced a folded sheet of paper from his rumpled jacket and spread it before Iris.
This is a contract for legal services. You signed one before for the divorce when you and Percy came to my office. I don't remember signing one, she said. We have it on file. You need to sign a new one before I can handle your claim against Varric. And you're sure this is all legal and everything? She asked, hesitant, uncertain. It struck David as odd that the potential client would ask the lawyer if the document was legal. Wally, though, did not inspire a sense of strict ethical standards. Her question did not faze him. All of our Crayox clients are signing these, he said, fudging a bit because Iris would technically be the first in her class to sign up. There were other fish in the pond, but no one had actually signed such a contract. She read it and signed it. As Wally stuffed it back into his pocket, he said, Now, listen, Iris, I need your help. I need for you to scope out other Crayox cases. Friends, family members, neighbors, anyone else who may have been injured by this drug. Our firm is offering a referral fee of $500 for a death case and $200 for a non-death case. Cash. Her eyes were suddenly dry. They narrowed, then a tiny smile formed at the corners of her lips. She was already thinking of others. David managed to maintain a lawyerly frown as he scribbled useless drivel on a legal pad and tried to digest what he was hearing. Was this ethical? Legal? Cash bribes to bring in more cases? Do you happen to know of another death case involving Crayox? Wally asked. Iris almost said something, but held her tongue. It was obvious she had a name. $500, huh? She said, her eyes suddenly darting from David's to Wally's. That's the deal. Who is it? There's a man. 2 blocks over, used to play poker with Percy. Croaked last year in the shower 2 months after my Percy passed. I know for a fact he was on Crayox.
Wally's eyes were wild.
What's his name? You said cash, right? 500 cash? I'd like to see it, Mr. Fig, before I give you another case. I sure need it.
Stung for a second, Wally rallied with a convincing lie.
Well, normally we make a withdrawal from the firm's litigation account. Keeps the bean counters happy, you know.
She folded her stump-like arms across her chest, stiffened her spine, narrowed her eyes, and said,
Fine, go make your withdrawal and bring me the cash. Then I'll give you the name.
Wally was reaching for his wallet.
Well, I'm not sure I have that much cash on me. David, how liquid are you?
David instinctively reached for his wallet. Iris watched with great suspicion as the lawyers scrambled to find cash. Wally produced 3 $20 bills and a $5 bill and looked hopefully at David, who found $220 in assorted denominations. If they had not stopped by Abner's to pay the tab, they could have come within $15 of covering Iris's referral fee.
I thought lawyers had plenty of money, Iris observed.
We keep it in the bank, Wally shot back, unwilling to concede an inch. Looks like we have about $285. I'll stop by tomorrow with the rest.
Iris was shaking her head no.
Come on, Iris, Wally pleaded. You're now our client. We're on the same team. We're talking about a huge settlement one day, and you won't trust us with $200?
I'll take an IOU, she said.
At this point, David preferred to stand his ground, show some pride, rake the cash off the table and say goodbye. But David was anything but sure-footed, and he knew it was not his call. Wally, on the other hand, was a rabid dog. He quickly scribbled an IOU on his legal pad, signed his name, and slid it across the table. Iris read it slowly, disapproved, then handed it to David.
You sign it too, she said.
For the first time since his great escape, David Zink questioned his wisdom. Approximately 48 hours earlier, he had been working on a complicated repackaging of high-grade bonds being sold by the government of India. All told, the deal involved around $15 billion. Now, in his new life as a street lawyer, he was being bullied by a 400-pound woman who was demanding his signature on a worthless piece of paper. He hesitated, took a deep breath, shot Wally a look of sheer bewilderment, then signed his name. The rundown neighborhood got dramatically worse the deeper they drove into it. The 2 blocks over Iris had mentioned was more like 5 blocks, and by the time they found the house and parked on the street in front of it, David was worried about their safety. The tiny home of the widow Cozart was a fortress, a small brick house on a narrow lot lined with 8-foot chain-link fencing. According to Iris, Herb Cozart was at war with the black teenage thugs who roamed the streets. He spent most of his days sitting on the front porch holding a shotgun, glaring at the punks and cursing them if they got too close. When he died, someone tied party balloons along the fence. Someone else tossed a string of firecrackers onto the front lawn in the middle of the night. Mrs. Cozart was planning to move, according to Iris. As David turned off the ignition, he looked down the street and said, "Oh, boy." Wally froze, looked in the same direction, and said, "This could be interesting." Five black males, teenagers, all dressed in the appropriate rapper garb, had noticed the shiny Audi and were giving it the once-over from 50 yards away. "I think I'll stay with the car," David said. "You can handle this one by yourself." "Good call. I'll make it quick." Wally jumped out with his briefcase. Iris had called ahead, and Mrs. Cozart was standing on the porch. The gang was moving toward the Audi. David locked the doors and thought of how nice it would be to have a pistol of some variety, just for protection. Something to show the boys so they would take their fun and games elsewhere. But armed only with a cell phone, he stuck it to his ear and pretended to be in deep conversation as the gang moved closer and closer. They surrounded the car, chatting nonstop, though David could not understand what they were saying. Minutes passed as David waited for a brick to crash through a window. They regrouped at the front bumper, and all five leaned back casually, as if they owned the car and needed to use it as a resting place. They rocked it gently, careful not to scratch or damage it. Then one of them lit a joint, and they passed it around. David thought about starting the engine and attempting to drive away, but that would create several problems, not the least of which was poor Wally getting stranded. He thought about lowering a window and engaging the boys in friendly banter, but they did not appear friendly at all. From the corner of his eye, David saw Mrs. Cozart's front door fly open and Wally storm out of the house. Wally reached into his briefcase, yanked out a very large black handgun, and yelled, "FBI! Get off the damn car!" The boys were too startled to move, or to move quickly enough, so Wally aimed at the clouds and fired a shot that sounded like a cannon. The five bolted, scattered, vanished. Wally stuffed the pistol into his briefcase and jumped into the car. "Let's get out of here," he said. David was already accelerating. "Punks," Wally hissed. "Do you always carry a gun?" David asked. "I have a permit. Yes, I always carry a gun. In this business, you might need one." "Do most lawyers carry guns?" "I don't care what most lawyers do, okay? It's not my job to protect most lawyers. I've been mugged twice in this city, so I ain't getting mugged again." David slid around a curve and sped through the neighborhood. Wally continued, "Crazy woman wanted some money. Iris, of course, called and said we were coming over, and of course she told Mrs. Cozart about the referral fee, but since the old gal is nuts, all she heard was the part about the $500. Did you sign her up?" "No, she demanded cash, which is pretty stupid because Iris should know that she took all our cash." "Where are we going now?" "To the office. She wouldn't even tell me her husband's date of death, so I figure we'll run a search and find out." "Why don't you do that when we get to the office?" "But he's not our client." "No, he's dead. And since his wife is crazy, and I mean this woman is really nuts, we can get a court-appointed administrator to approve his lawsuit." "More ways than one to skin a cat, David. You'll learn." "Oh, I'm learning. Isn't it against the law to discharge a firearm within the city limits?" Well, they did teach you something at Harvard." "Yes, that's true. And it's also against the law to discharge a firearm with a bullet that goes into the head of another person. It's called murder, and it happens at least once a day here in Chicago. And since there are so many murders, the police are overworked and have no time to fool with firearms that discharge bullets that fly harmlessly through the air. You thinking about turning me in or something?" "No, just curious. Does Oscar carry a gun?" "I don't think so, but he keeps one in a desk drawer. Oscar was assaulted once in his office by an irate divorce client. It was a simple no-fault divorce, uncontested on all issues, and Oscar somehow found a way to lose the case." "How do you lose an uncontested divorce?" "I don't know, but don't ask Oscar, okay? It's still a touchy subject. Anyway, he told the client that they would have to refile and go through the entire process again, and the client went crazy, beat the hell out of Oscar." "Oscar looks like he can take care of himself. Guy must have been a bad dude." "Who said it was a guy?" "A woman?" "Yep, a very large and angry woman, but a woman nonetheless. She got the drop on him by throwing her coffee cup, ceramic, not paper, and hitting him between the eyes. Then she grabbed his umbrella and started flailing away. 14 stitches. Valley Pennybaker was her name, never forget her." "Well, who broke it up?" "Rochelle finally got back there. Oscar swears she took her time, and she pulled Valley off and settled her down. Then she called the cops, and they hauled Valley away, charged her with aggravated assault. She countered with a lawsuit for malpractice.
Took 2 years and probably $5,000 to get it all settled. Now Oscar keeps a piece in his desk.
What would they think at Rogan Rothberg, David asked himself. Lawyers carrying guns, lawyers claiming to be FBI agents and firing into the air, lawyers being bloodied by unhappy clients. He almost asked Wally if he'd ever been assaulted by a client, but bit his tongue and let it pass. He thought he knew the answer.
Chapter 12. They returned to the apparent safety of the office at 4:30. The printer was spitting out sheets of paper. Rochelle was at the table sorting and arranging stacks of letters.
"What did you do to Deanna Nuxhall?" she growled at Wally. "Let's just say her divorce has been postponed until she can find a way to pay her lawyer. Why?" "She called here 3 times, crying and carrying on. Wanted to know what time you'd be back. Really wants to see you." "Good. That means she found the money."
Wally was scanning a letter from a stack on the table. He handed one to David, who took it and began reading. He was immediately hooked by the opening. "Beware of Crayox."
"Let's start signing," Wally said. "I want these in the mail this afternoon. The clock is ticking."
The letters were on Finley and Figg stationery and sent by the Honorable Wallace T. Figg, attorney and counselor at law. After the "sincerely" sign-off, there was room for only one signature.
"What am I supposed to do here?" David asked.
"Start signing my name," Wally replied.
"I'm sorry. Start signing my name. What, do you think I'm signing all 3,000 of these?"
"So I'm forging your name?"
"No, I hereby give you the authority to sign my name on these letters," Wally said slowly, as if speaking to an idiot. Then he looked at Rochelle and said, "And you too." "I've already signed 100, she said, as she handed another letter to David. "Look at that signature. A first grader could do better." And she was right. The signature was an effortless scrawl that began with a wavy roll that was probably meant to be a W, and then spiked dramatically for either the T or the F. David picked up one of the letters Wally had just signed and compared his signature with Rochelle's forgery. They were slightly similar, but both were illegible and indecipherable.
"Yes, this is pretty bad," David observed.
"It doesn't matter what you fling down. Can't nobody read it anyway," she added. "I think it's very distinguished," Wally said, signing away. "Now, can we all get busy?"
David sat down and began experimenting with his scrawl. Rochelle was folding, stuffing, and putting on stamps. After a few minutes, David asked, "Who are these people?"
"Our client database," Wally replied with great importance. "Over 3,000 names."
"Going back how far?"
"About 20 years, Rochelle said.
"So some of these folks have not been heard from in many years, right?"
"That's right," she said. "Some are probably dead, some moved away. A lot of these folks won't be too happy to get a letter from Finley and Figg." "If they're dead, let's hope Crayox got 'em," Wally blurted and followed it with a loud laugh. Neither David nor Rochelle saw the humor. A few minutes passed without a word. David was thinking about his room upstairs and all the work it needed. Rochelle was watching the clock, waiting on 5 p.m. Wally was happily casting a wider net for new clients.
"What kind of a response do you expect?" David asked. Rochelle rolled her eyes as if to say, "Zero." Wally paused for a second and shook the stiffness out of his signing hand.
"Great question," he admitted,
then rubbed his chin and gazed at the ceiling as if only he could answer such a complex question.
"Let's assume that 1% of the adult population in this country is taking Crayox. Now,
where do you get 1%? David interrupted.
"Research is in the file. Take it home tonight and learn the facts. So, as I was saying, 1% of our pool is about 30 people. If 20% of the pool has had problems with heart attacks or strokes, then we're down to about, say, 5 or 6 cases. Maybe 7 or 8, who knows? And if we believe, as I do, that each case, especially a death, is worth a couple mil, then we're looking at a very nice payday. I get the sense that nobody else around here believes me, but I'm not going to argue."
"I haven't said a word," Rochelle replied.
"Just curious, that's all," David said.
A couple of minutes passed, then he asked, "So when do we file some big lawsuit?" Wally, the expert, cleared his throat in preparation for a mini-seminar.
"Very soon. We have Iris Klopek signed up, so we could file tomorrow if we wanted. I plan to get Chester Marino's widow on board as soon as the funeral is over. These letters go out today. The phones will start ringing in a day or so. With some luck, we might have half a dozen cases in hand within a week, then we'll file. I'll start drafting the lawsuit tomorrow. It's important to file quickly in these mass tort cases. We'll drop the first bomb here in Chicago, get the headlines, and every person on Crayox will toss the drug and give us a call.
Oh, brother, Rochelle said.
Oh, brother is right. Wait till we get around to the settlement and I'll show you another, oh, brother.
State or federal court? David asked, quick to throttle the bickering.
Good question, and I'd like for you to research the issue.
If we go into state court, we can also sue the doctors who prescribed Crayox to our clients. That's more defendants, but also more high-powered defense lawyers causing trouble. Frankly, there's enough money at Varick Labs to make us all happy, so I'm inclined to keep the doctors out of it. On the federal side, because the Crayox litigation will go nationwide, we can plug into the mass tort network and ride their coattails. No one really expects these cases to go to trial, and when the settlement negotiations begin, we need to be hooked in with the big boys. Again, Wally sounded so knowledgeable that David wanted to believe him. But he'd already been at the firm long enough to know that Wally had never handled a mass tort case, nor had Oscar. Oscar's door opened, and he emerged with his usual frown and look of fatigue.
"What the hell is this?" he said pleasantly.
No one responded. He walked to the table, picked up a letter, then dropped it. He was about to say something when the front door burst open, and a tall, thick, burly, tattooed Philistine stomped in and yelled at the entire room,
"Which one is Fig?"
With no hesitation, Oscar and David and even Rochelle pointed at Wally, who was wild-eyed and frozen. Behind the intruder was a tart in a yellow dress, Deanna Nuxhall from divorce court, and she yelled,
"That's him, Tripp, the short, fat one."
Tripp went straight for Wally as if he might kill him. The rest of the firm scrambled away from the table, leaving Wally to fend for himself. Tripp made a couple of fists, hovered over Wally, and said,
"Look, Fig, you little weasel, we're getting married Saturday, so my girl here needs her divorce tomorrow. What's the problem?"
Wally, still seated and hunkering down in anticipation of a beating, said,
"Well, I would like to get paid."
"She promised to pay you later, didn't she?"
"I sure did," Deanna added helpfully.
"If you touch me, I'll have you arrested," Wally said. "You can't get married if you're in jail."
"I told you he was a smartass," Deanna said.
Because he needed to hit something but was not quite ready to slap Wally around, Tripp backhanded a stack of Crayox letters and sent them flying.
"Get the divorce, okay, Fig? I'll be there tomorrow in court, and if my girl doesn't get her divorce then, I'll stomp your chubby little ass right there in the courtroom."
"Call the police," Oscar barked at Rochelle, who was too frightened to move. Tripp needed something with more drama, so he grabbed a thick law book off the table and tossed it through a front window. Glass shattered and rattled across the porch. AC yelped, but retreated to a hiding place under Rochelle's desk. Tripp's eyes were shiny and glazed.
"I'll snap your neck, Fig. You got that?"
"Hit him, Tripp," Deanna urged.
David glanced at the sofa and saw Wally's briefcase. He eased closer to it.
"We'll be in court tomorrow, Fig. You gonna be there?"
Tripp took another step closer. Wally braced for the assault. Rochelle moved in the direction of her desk, and this upset Tripp.
"Don't move. You're not calling the cops."
"Call the police," Oscar barked again, but made no effort to do so himself. David inched closer to the briefcase.
"Talk to me, Fig," Tripp demanded.
"He embarrassed me in open court," Deanna whined.
It was obvious she wanted bloodshed.
"You're a slimeball, Fig. You know that?"
Wally was about to say something clever when Tripp finally made contact. He pushed Wally, a rather benign little shove that seemed tame in light of the buildup, but it was an assault nonetheless.
"Hey, watch it,"
Wally barked, slapping at Tripp's hand. David quickly opened the briefcase and withdrew the long black 44 Magnum Colt. He was not certain if he had ever touched a revolver, and he wasn't sure he could do so now without blowing his hand off, but he knew to avoid the trigger. "Here, Wally," he said as he placed the gun on the table. Wally snatched it and jumped from his chair, and the rules of engagement changed dramatically. Tripp blurted, "Holy shit!" in a high-pitched voice and took a long step back. Deanna ducked behind him, whimpering. Rochelle and Oscar were as stunned as Tripp was by the weapon. Wally did not aim the gun at anyone, not directly anyway, but he handled it in such a way that there was little doubt he could and would unload a few rounds in a matter of seconds.
"First, I want an apology," he said as he moved toward Tripp, who had lost his swagger. You got a lot of balls coming in here and making demands when your girl there won't pay her bills.
Tripp, who no doubt had some experience in handguns, stared at the Colt and said meekly,
Yeah, sure, you're right, man.
Call the police, Ms. Gibson, Wally said, and she dialed 911. AC poked his head out and growled at Tripp.
I want $300 for the divorce and $200 for the window, Wally demanded.
Tripp was still backing away, with Deanna practically unseen behind him.
Be cool, man, Tripp said, both palms facing Wally.
Oh, I'm very cool.
Do something, baby, Deanna said.
Like what, you see the size of that thing?
Can't we just get out of here, she asked.
No, Wally replied, not until the cops get here.
He raised the gun a few inches, careful not to point it directly at Tripp. Rochelle backed away from her desk and went to the kitchen.
Be cool, man, Tripp pleaded. We're leaving.
No, you're not.
The police arrived in minutes. Tripp was handcuffed and placed in the back seat of a patrol car. Deanna cried without effect, then she tried flirting with the cops, and this proved slightly more useful. In the end, though, Tripp was hauled away to face charges of assault and vandalism. When the excitement was over, Rochelle and Oscar went home, leaving Wally and David to sweep up the broken glass and finish signing the Crayox letters. They worked for an hour, mindlessly signing Wally's name and also discussing what to do about the broken window. It could not be replaced until the following day, and the office wouldn't survive the night with a missing window. Preston wasn't a dangerous neighborhood, but no one left keys in cars or doors unlocked. Wally had just made the decision to sleep at the office on the sofa next to the table, with AC nearby and the Colt within reach, when the front door swung open and dear Deanna popped in for the second time.
What are you doing here? Wally demanded.
We need to talk, Wally, she said in a voice that was unsteady and much softer.
She sat in a chair near Rochelle's desk and crossed her legs in such a way as to leave most of the flesh exposed. She had very nice legs and was wearing the same hooker's heels she had displayed in court that morning.
Ooh la la, Wally said under his breath. Then, and what would you like to talk about? He asked.
I think she's been drinking, David whispered as he kept signing.
I'm not sure I should marry Tripp, she announced.
He's a brute, a real loser, Deanna. You can do better than that.
But I really want my divorce, Wally. Can't you help me out here?
Then pay me.
I can't get the money before court tomorrow. I swear that's the truth.
Then too bad.
David decided that had the case been his, he would do whatever necessary to get the divorce, so Deanna and Tripp would be history. An extra $300 wasn't worth all the hassle.
She recrossed her legs and her skirt inched up even higher.
I was thinking, Wally, that maybe we could make some other arrangements. You know, just me and you.
Wally sighed, looked at the legs, thought for a second, and said,
Can't do it. I gotta stay here tonight because some jackass knocked out the front window.
Then I'll stay too, she cooed, licking her bright red lips.
Wally had never possessed the willpower to run from these situations, not that he encountered them all the time. Seldom had a client been so open and obvious. In fact, he could not, at that dreadful yet thrilling moment, remember one being so easy.
We might work something out, he said, leering at Deanna.
I'm out of here, David said, jumping to his feet and grabbing his briefcase.
You can hang around, she said.
The visual was instantaneous and ugly. Happily married David romping around with a cute slut who'd had as many divorces as her chubby and naked lawyer. David ran for the door and slammed it behind him. Their favorite late-night bistro was within walking distance of their home in Lincoln Park. They had often met there for a quick dinner just before the kitchen closed at 11. Just as David staggered home from another crushing day at the office. Tonight, though, they arrived before 9 and found the place bustling. Their table was in a corner. At some point, about halfway through his 5-year career at Rogan Rothberg, David had adopted the policy of not discussing his work, of never bringing it home. It was so unpleasant and distasteful and boring to boot, he simply could not dump it on Helen. She happily went along with this policy, and so they usually talked about her studies or what their friends were doing. But things were suddenly different. The big firm was gone, as were the faceless clients and their tedious files. Now David worked with real people who did incredible things that had to be retold in great detail. Take, for example, the 2 near gunfights David had survived with his sidekick, Wally. At first, Helen flatly refused to believe that Wally had actually fired a shot in the air to scatter the street thugs, but she eventually softened under David's relentless narrative. Nor did she believe the trip story on the first telling. She was equally skeptical of the Wally-Judge Bradbury shakedown of Deanna Nuxhall in open court. She was incredulous that her husband would fork over all of his cash to Iris Klopek, then sign an IOU for more. Oscar getting mauled by an angry, female, divorce client was slightly more believable. Saving the best for last, David wrapped up his unforgettable first day at Finley and Fig with, "And dear, even as we speak, Wally and Deanna are naked on the sofa having a romp with the window open and the dog watching and the unpaid fee getting satisfied in spectacular fashion. You're lying. I wish. The $300 will be forgiven and Deanna will be divorced by noon tomorrow." What a sleazeball. Which one? How about both? Do most of your clients pay this way? I doubt it. I mentioned Iris Klopek. I suspect she's more in line with the firm's client profile. The fee couch couldn't hold up under the pounding. You can't work for these people, David. Come on. Quit Rogan if you want, but let's find a different firm somewhere. These two clowns are a couple of crooks. What about ethics? I doubt if they spend much time discussing ethics. Why not look for a nice mid-sized firm somewhere with nice people who don't carry guns and chase ambulances and swap labor for sex? What's my specialty, Helen? Something to do with bonds? Right. I know a lot about high-yield, long-term bonds issued by foreign governments and corporations. That's all I know about the law because that's all I've done for the past 5 years. Put that on a resume and the only people who might call are a handful of eggheads at other large firms, just like Rogan, who might be in need of someone like me. But you can learn. Of course I can, but no one will hire a 5-year lawyer at a nice salary and put him in kindergarten. They demand experience, and I don't have it. So Finley and Fig is the only place you can work? Or someplace like it? I'll treat it like a seminar for a year or two, then maybe open my own shop. Great. One day on the job and you're already thinking about leaving. Not really. I love the place. You've lost your mind. Yes. And it's so liberating.
Chapter 13. Wally's mass mailing scheme proved futile. Half of the letters were returned by the postal service for a variety of reasons. Phone traffic spiked a bit in the week that followed, though most of the calls were from former clients who demanded to be removed from Finley and Fig's mailing list. Undaunted, Wally filed a lawsuit in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, naming Iris Klopek and Millie Marino, as well as others to be named later, and claimed their loved ones had been killed by the drug Crayox, manufactured by Varick Labs. Throwing darts, Wally asked for an even $100 million in total damages, and he demanded a trial by jury. The filing was not nearly as dramatic as he wished. He tried desperately to attract the media to the lawsuit he was brewing, but there was little interest. Instead of simply filing it online, he and David, both dressed in their finest dark suits, drove to the Everett M. Dirksen U.S. Courthouse in downtown Chicago and hand-delivered the 20-page lawsuit to the clerk. There were no reporters and no photographers, and this upset Wally. He harangued a deputy clerk into snapping a photograph of the two grim-faced lawyers as they filed the lawsuit. Once back at the office, he emailed the lawsuit and the photograph to the Tribune, the Sun-Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time, Newsweek, and a dozen other publications. David prayed the photograph would go unnoticed, but Wally got lucky. A reporter from the Tribune called the office and was immediately put through to an ecstatic attorney Fig. The avalanche of publicity began. On the front page of Section B, the following morning, a headline read, "Chicago Attorney Attacks Varick Labs Over Crayox." The article summarized the lawsuit and said local attorney Wally Fig was a self-described mass tort specialist. Finley and Fig was a boutique firm with a long history of fighting big drug companies. The reporter, though, did some sniffing and quoted two well-known plaintiffs' lawyers as saying, in effect, "We've never heard of these guys." And there was no record of similar lawsuits filed by Finley and Fig during the past 10 years. Varick responded aggressively by defending its product, promising a vigorous defense and looking forward to a fair trial before an impartial jury to clear our good name. The reproduced photograph was rather large. This tickled Wally and embarrassed David. They were quite a pair, Wally was balding, rotund, and badly dressed, while David was taller, trimmer, and much younger looking. The story went wild on the internet, and the phone rang nonstop. At times, Rochelle was overwhelmed, and David helped out. Some of the callers were reporters, others were lawyers sniffing around for information, but most were Crayox users who were terrified and confused. David wasn't sure what to say. The firm's strategy, if it could be called that, was to pick through the net and take the death cases, then at some undefined point in the future corral the non-death clients and lump them into a class action. This was impossible to explain over the phone because David didn't quite grasp it himself. As the phones rang and the excitement continued, even Oscar came out of his office and showed some interest. His little firm had never seen such activity, and, well, maybe this was indeed their big moment. Maybe Wally was finally right about something. Maybe, just maybe, this could lead to real money, which meant, at long last, the divorce he so fervently wanted, followed immediately by retirement. The three lawyers met at the table late in the day to compare notes. Wally was wired, even perspiring. He waved his legal pad in the air and said, "We've got four death cases here, brand new ones, and we got to sign them up right now. Are you in, Oscar?" "Sure, I'll take one," Oscar said, trying to appear reluctant, as always. "Thank you. Now, Ms. Gibson, there's a black lady who lives on 19th, not far from you, Bassett Towers, number 3. She says it's safe." "I will not go to Bassett Towers," Rochelle said. "I can practically hear the gunfire from my apartment." "That's my point. It's right down the street from you. You could stop by on the way home." "I will not." Wally slammed his legal pad onto the table. "Can't you see what's happening here, damn it? These people are begging us to take their cases, cases that are worth millions of bucks. There could be a huge settlement within a year. We're on the verge of something big here, and you, as always, couldn't care less." "I will not risk my neck for this law firm." "Great. So when Varick settles and the cash pours in, you will forego your share of the bonus. That's what you're telling us?" "What bonus?" Wally walked to the front door and back to the table, pacing. "Well, well, how quickly we forget. Remember the Sherman case last year, Ms. Gibson? Nice little car wreck, a rear-ender. State Farm paid $60,000. We took a third, a nice fee of $20,000 for good old Finley and Fig. We paid some bills. I took $7,000, Oscar took $7,000, and we gave you $1,000 cash under the table. Didn't we, Oscar?" "Yes, and we've done it before," Oscar said. Rochelle was calculating as Wally was talking. It would be a shame to miss a piece of the lottery. What if Wally was right for a change? He shut up and things were quiet and tense for a moment as the air cleared. AC rose to his feet and began growling. Seconds passed, then the distant sound of an ambulance could be heard. It grew louder, but oddly no one moved to the window or to the front porch. Had they already lost interest in their bread and butter? Had the little boutique firm suddenly outgrown car wrecks and moved on to a far more lucrative field? "How much of a bonus?" she asked. "Come on, Ms. Gibson," Wally said, exasperated. "I have no idea."